From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we listen in on Bonnie North's onstage interview with former astronaut Scott Kelly. Kelly spent a year on the International Space Station and wrote a book about his time in space. But Kelly says his long career in the military and at NASA would have been unlikely for him until the fateful day he picked up Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff.
I read the stories about the fighter pilots that became the test pilots that became the original Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts. And I recognized, you know, traits that these guys had in themselves, that how it was written in the book, that I could really relate to. I felt like I had in myself, with one exception. You know, I couldn't do my homework or pay attention or be a good student. And I thought, you know, if I could solve that problem, I could be just like them.
A conversation with astronaut Scott Kelly next on Lake Effect, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for listening today. I'm Mitch Tyke. Astronaut Scott Kelly set what was then an American endurance record when he spent more than 11 months aboard the International Space Station from 2015 to 2016. That record has been surpassed twice since then. It was his third time aboard the space station after a career that also involved space shuttle flights. But on the third ISS mission, Kelly was himself a subject of a science experiment. Researchers were monitoring him in space while they monitored his twin brother, Mark Kelly, on the ground. The results have yet to be published, but are expected to yield insights into the effects of long-term spaceflight on the body. Kelly himself shared insights on his trip while he was in Milwaukee in October to speak at the UWM Union in an event sponsored by Boswell Book Company. Lake Effect's Bonnie North hosted the event, and let's listen to some of Kelly's opening remarks right now.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for buying my book, and I think you will enjoy it. You know, it's great to be here. Actually, after a year in space, it's great to be anywhere with gravity. On the space station, I changed positions so many times, you would have thought I was running for president. That's just a joke. So to those of you in the audience here that do not appear to be space aliens, I'd like to say good evening. And to the rest of you, I come in peace. So I'm going to read a little bit from the book so you can hear it in my own voice. And I'm going to start not where Tom Wolfe told me to start, because he said begin at the beginning. I'm going to begin at the end, which is the prologue, which doesn't make sense. But it actually starts in after I got back to my house after being in space for a year and flying back to the U.S. And I'll just read from this briefly, and then we'll start just like a discussion about the book and about my story. I'm sitting at the head of my dining room table at home in Houston, finishing dinner with my family, my longtime girlfriend, Amiko, my daughters, Samantha and Charlotte, my twin brother, Mark, his wife, Gabby, his daughter, Claudia, our father, Richie, and Amiko's son, Corbin. It's a simple thing, sitting at a table and eating a meal with those you love, and many do it every day without giving it much thought. For me, it's something I've been dreaming of for almost a year. I contemplated what it would be like to eat this meal so many times. Now that I'm finally here, it doesn't seem entirely real. The faces of the people I love that I haven't seen for so long, the chatter of many people talking together, the clink of silverware, the swish of wine in a glass, these are all unfamiliar. Even the sensation of gravity holding me in my chair feels strange. And every time I put a glass or fork down on the table, there's a part of my mind that is looking for a dot of Velcro or a strip of duct tape to hold it in place. I've been back on Earth for 48 hours. I push back from the table and struggle to stand up, feeling like an old man getting out of a recliner. Stick a fork in me. I'm done, I announce. You know, eventually I go to bed, and then when I wake up a few hours later, I actually wake up with flu-like symptoms, and then I write, I struggle to get up, find the edge of the bed, feet down, sit up, stand up. At every stage, I feel like I'm fighting through quicksand. When I'm finally vertical, the pain in my legs is awful. And on top of that pain, I feel something even more alarming. All the blood in my body is rushing to my legs, like the sensation of the blood rushing to your head when you do a headstand, but in reverse. I can feel the tissue in my legs swelling. I shuffle my way to the bathroom, moving my weight from one foot to the other with deliberate effort, left, right, left, right. I make it to the bathroom, flip on the light, and look down at my legs. They are swollen and alien stumps, not legs at all. Any kids in here? How old? Four? Oh, I say. Amico, come look at this. You didn't hear that, did you? Anyway.
Thank you. Well, that actually, before we get to the actual book, that leads to a question that I have about the physical toll that year took on you. I mean, you describe in the book some experiments that you did with mice where, you know, you were studying, or scientists were studying, what was happening with muscle atrophy. And essentially, you gave your body to science before you were done with it by doing this mission. Was it worth it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was the not only the hardest thing I have ever done in my entire life, but the most rewarding thing. And that's why I wanted to do it. That's why I wanted to spend a year in space. So initially, I was not too enthused about the idea when it was brought up to me. I had just recently flown a six-month flight, which I used to call a long-duration flight. Not anymore. But that's why I did it, because I knew it would be harder, and that's what, you know, that challenge excited me about the idea eventually.
Doing the hard things.
Yeah.
You talk about that in the book a lot.
Yeah.
About wanting to always do the hard things.
Well, it's not really about always wanting to do them, but it's more about, like, never turning them down. You know, and I always had this sense of, you know, mission that required me to say yes when I really didn't want to.
So why the book? Was that also a hard thing?
So when I got to space this last time, and it was the my fourth flight into space, I had flown three times previously, and because I was going to be on the space station for longer than any American had ever been in space, I thought, you know, this might be a good story for a book, right? Makes sense. And but then when I was kind of writing my own, or just thinking about, like, my life story and my path to being the guy on the space station for a year, I thought, you know, even going back to when I was a kid, this could be a story that really resonates with a lot of people, because it's not just a story about me being in space, which is kind of the framework of the book. It's also the story of this kid who, when I was younger, and the little kids in here, don't take this as a plan. This shouldn't be your life plan, because it was hard to recover from. But when I was a kid, I was a really bad student. And I was the kid that would be looking out the window or looking at the clock, trying to make it go faster than I ever did paying attention in school. It was absolutely impossible for me to do it. And I think if I was a kid today, I'd be the kid with, you know, ADD or ADHD. Then I basically meandered through my first 13 years of school, not being able to study, graduated in the bottom half of my class, went to college. Actually went to the wrong college, though. And I don't mean like I went to this school thinking this one was a better fit for me. What I mean is I applied to and showed up at this school thinking I was going to this school over here. I'm quite possibly the only person to ever do this. And I get there, and I'm like, hey, when's the football game? Like, we don't have a football team. That's at other school in Maryland. And I was just basically doing the same thing I had always done. I couldn't pay attention. I wasn't doing my homework. Wasn't doing well. Eventually not even going to class very much. And then one day I walk into the college bookstore to buy, like, gum or something. Not a book. Not sure I had ever bought a book before. But I go into the bookstore, and I see this book on the shelf on the end. It's got this red, white, and blue cover, and it had a title that looked really cool, and it showed, like, motion in a very positive direction. And I picked it up, and I started, you know, looking in it, and I read the back. And I was interested enough in it that I took my gum money and purchased the book. took it back to my dorm room and laid there for the next few days on my unmade dorm room bed. And I read the stories about the fighter pilots that became the test pilots, that became the original Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts. And I recognized, you know, traits that these guys had in themselves, that how it was written in the book, that I could really relate to. I felt like I had in myself, with one exception. You know, I couldn't do my homework or pay attention or be a good student. And I thought, you know, if I could solve that problem, I could be just like them. And if it wasn't, and I know what you're thinking, you know, that's a giant leap, really. 18-year-old kid can't do his homework, decides that he's going to be, reads a book, decides he's going to become an astronaut. But really what it was a bunch of very small, manageable steps. And if I look back on that day, I was 18 years old, and I read a book that was my spark, that motivated me, inspired me to do something really, really challenging. 18 years later, almost to the day, I was flying in space for the first time, the first American in my class of 35 American astronauts to fly in space. And I think, you know, that's a really great story that might, you know, inspire some other people to do things that they might not think is possible.
You didn't start out thinking that this was going to be a path. So that was a long, hard 18 years to get to that first flight.
Well, I had a plan, and I didn't know if I was going to make it there. I had a backup plan, too. It's always good to have a backup plan, maybe several.
Which was?
I was going to stay in the Navy, and I wanted to be the commanding officer, the captain of an aircraft carrier someday. You know, I didn't get to do that, but I got to be the captain of a more expensive ship. Much more expensive.
What traits do you think made you a good astronaut? What did they see in you?
Whew. You know, I'm not... Part of the selection when you get picked is you need to be, you know, technically capable of doing the job. And in my case, I was a military pilot and test pilot. Wasn't the greatest pilot in the beginning. I know that's hard to believe, but I wasn't. You know, I think, you know, my brother says, you know, how we, you know, how we do something or how capable we are, you know, is no indication of how good we are when we start or something. I'm going to stop quoting him. It's... Anyway, so, you know, being a, you know, a test pilot in the military requires certain skills, and then you, you know, assuming you have those, you go interview, and then I think it's more of a, you know, NASA is more about, you know, who they think would be good teammates, who would they like to work with, and then being a successful astronaut, you know, once you get selected, I think is more of a matter of, you know, having, you know, the technical rigor to learn the systems and to operate them very, very precisely, very carefully. On the space shuttle, there are 2,000 switches and circuit breakers inside, some of which, you know, if you push one of these buttons at the wrong time, you can blow the thing up, you know, you and your crewmates along with you. And so technical precision is very important, but also for spending, you know, a long time on the space station, certainly, you know, teamwork and being able to be isolated for a long time. And in some ways, I think even the ADD I think I have was kind of helpful, because I think I've always felt like one advantage I had over some of my crew members is that, you know, some really type A motivated people is they always have to do everything perfectly. And it was easy for me to just kind of let certain things go that I didn't think was as important and just focus on the really important stuff. And maybe, you know, ADD helps in that case.
You had that filter.
Yeah, I had the ability to just let go and say, hey, I know this is some, we're supposed to be doing this, but let's not spend all of our energy on it because, you know, we got all this other stuff to worry about that's more important.
One of the things you capture so well, at least I imagine, because of course I haven't been in space, but you talk about the tedium of it. And of course, I think all of us who grew up on watching Star Trek and other science fiction things, we have a much more romantic idea of what spaceflight is. But you talk about the timeline that just ticks along and that you have to meet, and that the repetitive tasks and things take all of your concentration, yeah. and there never seems to be a break. Mm-hmm. And did it feel as tedious as you were doing it?
Well, first of all, if Star Trek really had like microgravity, they would have a lot of tedious things they had to do too, because gravity helps so much in our lives. I mean, you have no idea. I mean, it just makes just about everything is easier to do, with the exception of like moving very, very heavy objects, or you know, putting yourself in a weird position. Like if you were trying to connect your like VCR, if anyone remember what a VCR is, connect your VCR to the TV. That weird position. That's easier. But yeah, it is a you know, but partly due to that, it is a tedious routine, which to me, in some ways, made the days go by quick, because you're rushing from one thing to another. But the weeks seem to drag on.
You talked about counting up rather than counting down. And did that help?
And so what she's referring to is, when I got on board the space station, my plan was to never count down the days remaining, because there were too many. And I had been given the advice of, when you do something like this, maybe you just want to count up. As if every day is something you've collected, an achievement, you know, like collecting baseball cards. You have more of them. I had more days in space. Now, unfortunately, my plan didn't work very well, because when we got to day 100, my Russian colleague, Misha, started telling me every day how many days we had left. And I guess, yeah. And he really didn't understand what I meant when I said, Misha, stop telling me that.
Scott Kelly's book is called Endurance. We'll hear more of his interview with Bonnie North in just a moment. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich, and back with more of Bonnie North's onstage interview with astronaut Scott Kelly. Kelly spent nearly a year aboard the International Space Station, and his book about the experience is called Endurance.
Do you think space travel will ever be available to someone like me? You know, relatively healthy, but middle-aged, short, bad eyesight, kind of a dodgy hip, you know. Is that ever going to be possible? We might go to the moon, like I'm going to hop over and go shopping?
You know, forever is a long time, so I think absolutely. You know, will it be commonplace in our lifetime? I hope so. I think it can be. You know, there are challenges. You know, flying in space is risky. There's a lot of energy involved to get us there. There's a lot of energy involved to get us home, and that you have to remove all that that speed from your spacecraft. But I do think, you know, we have companies that are working on this, and, you know, I would imagine within the next 10 years it's going to be like the early days of aviation, where you have some people can afford and, you know, are willing to take the risk of flying in space. I think some people will get killed initially, like in airplanes. But the more we do it, the more experience we get, the more, you know, the cost is brought down, you know, the bigger the economy of spaceflight gets, I think we can possibly even bring down costs and make it safer. So someday.
There are a lot of things, of course, you say technical and medical that we have to, and that's part of why you were up there, is to mm-hmm. find out what it does to the human body to be up there in microgravity, to have that kind of radiation exposure.
Yeah.
What do you think what do we need to solve before we can make it a reality for kind of the rest of us?
Well, I think going to low Earth orbit for a vacation, you know, near the Earth, within the protection of the Earth's magnetic field, and not, you know, spending years and years in space. From a you know, human physiology standpoint, I think we're fine. You know, we can do that right now. You know, it's not going to be a destination for everybody, because it is kind of a harsh environment to live in. But certainly, a lot of people will like it, especially for short periods of time. You know, I think the perfect flight would be like maybe 3 days long to space, and then, you know, you come home and you can use your bathroom at home.
You can shower. You
can take a shower.
You can deal with water.
Yeah.
I mean, that was such an evocative thing. Mm. The way you wrote about the first thing you did was walk through your house and just get in the pool.
Yeah.
To feel water on your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be some of the things that we would miss as a species, is feeling the things that we know, our sensory input.
Absolutely. There's a lot of things we miss when we're in space about Earth. Clear. Yeah, absolutely. And I write in the book that, you know, someday there might be a word for that, you know, as we develop into, a species that some of us might live in space for really long periods of time. You know, there'll be a word for the stuff of that, you know, the things of Earth that we miss.
Right. The homesickness that we don't have a word yet for. Mm-hmm. There's a little part, it's just a very short part towards the end of the book where you talk about taking care of some flowers mm-hmm. that you were growing. And I found that really amazingly touching because it was this living thing you felt so connected to mm-hmm. and that you wanted to make sure that it survived.
Well, initially, later I became connected to it as I started taking care of them and they got better. Originally, the reason I became attached to these flowers was because some guy trolled me on the internet and said I was no Mark Watney because my flowers were dying. So, you know, he threw down the gauntlet and I had to bring them back because of that. But then once they started flourishing, then I found like I really appreciated having them and I liked having them there and it was fun to take care of them.
Was it good to actually touch the leaves?
And well, I needed to do that to water them because what happened was the ground would tell me when to water the flowers and there was so much bureaucracy between me and the guy who decided how much water the flowers needed that by the time I showed him the dead flowers that needed water, you know, he wouldn't get the word until like days later and we were like 180 out. They were either soggy and he was telling me to water them more or they were dying and mm-hmm. he said they needed less water. So eventually I just went and did it myself and decided.
Well, and bureaucracy is, I mean, we think of things like NASA, like the military, as big, bureaucratic, slow-moving entities. And in a lot of ways, they are. And one of the frustrations that you express in the book is the CO2 levels, mm-hmm. that you are constantly fighting with the ground control. We need more fresh, we need oxygen, we need less CO2. And that this was they didn't seem to think that you needed that.
Well, you know, we are a priority, clearly the people in space, but they also have a little bit more complex problem in that we only have so much spare parts and they have to think long term. So, you know, on one hand, you kind of feel sorry for yourself, so you don't really think of the bigger picture that they have to manage a much, longer period of time, have to worry about, you know, how much CO2 the guys are going to have a year from now. But me elevating that as an issue definitely got a lot of attention. And they do recognize that they need to do a better job, especially when we start getting further away from Earth. And, you know, this equipment has to be much more robust because, you know, if you're going to Mars and the toilet breaks and you can't fix it, you're going to die. So this hardware needs to work much better for those kind of trips, I think.
Well, and that... I found I hadn't thought about it quite that way and until I was reading your book and thinking, you know, it's the simple things here on Earth. It's having a working toilet. It's having potable water.
Oh, yeah.
It's having breathable air that we just take for granted.
Yeah, there's a lot we take for granted here on Earth. Absolutely. Yeah, the water thing, you know, we take our urine on the space station and we turn it into water, which we drink. We turn it into urine again, clearly.
It's a closed system.
Yeah, it's closed loop. Then we drink it again. Actually, we drink it again after we turn it to water. And I know what you're thinking, that guy drank his pee for a whole year, right? I drank everyone's pee. It's all mixed together. But it does taste better than the water in Florida. Yeah, some of that water we make oxygen with through electrolysis. And it's a pretty efficient system, actually. It's a really good example of like the space station, a renewable energy system where we, you know, take solar energy to power all the hardware and then we, you know, scrub the atmosphere of contaminants. We make our own water. Absolutely.
Did you have a favorite experiment? I know you had to do a lot of different kinds while you were up there.
So we, on the space station, there's 400 different scientific experiments going on or went on during the course of the year I was there, some of which I was very involved with, like the medical tests that were done on Misha and me. I would have to, you know, every couple of weeks I would take my own blood, you know, in the morning. We do it ourselves, believe it or not, because it's easier. You wouldn't think it would be, but in space where crew time is so critical, once you get the hang of it, actually sticking a needle in your vein and taking the blood yourself is more efficient and better for the space program, because you don't have to have two people doing it. But also, you know, other tests we would do on each other, ultrasounds, you know, our vessels in our head, our hearts, legs. I actually had 8 tattoos put on me for this flight, so it would just be save a lot of time that I wouldn't have to make all these reference marks before I did all these ultrasounds. Now, unfortunately, one of these tattoos is on my neck. So I was told there's like certain jobs I can't get now because I got a neck tat.
It's a gang tattoo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a prison. It looks like one of those looks like one of those eye drops. Those little tears. People are like, why do you have that on your neck? Space tattoo.
Space tattoo.
It's a star. It's a small star.
It's a space
it's
a gang.
Dot. It's
I
a
like
planet.
It. I like it.
Yeah.
I think you should do that.
Yeah. But we have a lot of experiments, and some of those experiments are, you know, Earth-focused, basic science, biology, chemistry, physics, combustion efficiency technology, combustion technology, pharmaceuticals. We've actually developed drugs for certain things that happen to us as we age, but happen at a very accelerated rate in space. So it's a good place to do that kind of science. And we had a bunch of mice on the space station, 20 female mice. On board that we did some experiments with. And I found that to be interesting because it was so technically complicated and precise, you know, operating on these little tiny mice in space and taking their samples. And, you know, we're lucky we have these animals because we can learn a lot from them, and they're the unwilling, you know, they do this unwillingly, but we still, I think, need to appreciate their sacrifice for us.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a big one. Yeah. You talked about things coming up during the time that you were up there. Two of the three refueling or resupply didn't make it.
Yeah, the first two, when I was there, we lost a Russian Progress resupply ship, crashed into the Pacific Ocean. And then SpaceX, we had a SpaceX resupply ship blew up on the way to us. And yeah, that's kind of a bummer when you lose all this stuff you were expecting to get. And all of a sudden we're going through like garbage bags looking for food that we don't want to throw away unnecessarily. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, when you're going through a bag of old food and you pull out some guy's old underwear, it's not pleasant.
Most of that stuff gets put on a rocket and burnt up in space, though, right? When you leave?
Yeah, most of the garbage we generate gets burned up in the atmosphere. So, and that's everything. I mean, everything we throw away, most of it gets burned up. So when you wish upon that shooting star, you might be wishing on some guy's dirty underwear.
And another story that you told, and I actually, as I was reading it, almost could feel myself salivating, where I think it was the British astronaut came up with a corned beef sandwich.
The bacon. The bacon sarnie.
Bacon sarnie. That's what it
my
was.
My God. That was a horrible moment. Misha and I were like two dogs on the floor looking up on steak night.
He didn't share?
He did, but he didn't. He had no idea. He's a great guy, by the way. But he had no idea. Like, he just assumed that the BLT was available to everybody, I think.
Where did he think they were coming from?
Well, now there's, like, they have their own space food. I guess he didn't realize that the British, you know, his management in the UK sent him special food. He didn't realize it. So Misha and I had been up there for probably about, I don't know, 9 months at this point. And, you know, there's not only is there no BLT, there's no sandwich.
Well, you mentioned Misha, and he and Granati, and who was the...
Sergei Volkov. Sergei, other kind of, yeah.
You write with them, you write about them with such fondness. Yeah. And obviously you are compatriots and friends in a very profound way. One of the things you also write about is the Russian difference of how you approach everything.
Yeah.
And how starkly that comes into relief when you're living on the space station together.
Mm-hmm.
And so did that shock you the first couple of times you rubbed up against that?
Well, you know, my first impression of the Russians were that when I started working for the space program, were that these were my former enemies that I was trained to shoot down in my F-14 Tomcat that I flew as a Navy fighter pilot. You know, once you get beyond that, there's the, you know, the stoicism of the Russian culture and how they seem very, you know, kind of tough, hard people, and it seems like a shell that's difficult to get past. In the book, I describe just Russians in general, and I didn't think I made this word up. I thought I had actually read it somewhere, but I couldn't ever find this phrase again. So I couldn't credit anyone, but I said I did look for it and try to figure out where I saw this. I thought it was in a Russian novel, but I described them as the Brotherhood of the Downtrodden, meaning that, you know, they are just brought together by, you know, all this bad stuff that has happened to them, to their country throughout history. So your initial impression is, you know, these people are, you know, tough because that's how they appear. But once you get to know them, they're, you can become friends with a Russian much quicker than you can with an American. And the depth of that friendship is more stronger and meaningful. You know, you can develop that a lot quicker than you can with, you know, in the American culture. It's my opinion.
You also say in the Russian language, it's a much more complex set of linguistical descriptions of friendship and of love and,
yeah,
and of affection.
Yeah, and I was saying that to counter that they have this whole language of cursing that is much more extensive than compared to ours in English. But at the same time, they have also a much more extensive language to recognize friendship. So it's interesting.
Are you still in touch with them?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You guys get together at all?
Well, the Russian guys live in Russia. And
yeah. But Scott,
but yeah,
there are airplanes.
Yeah, when they're there or when they're here or I'm there, yeah, absolutely.
Are they still part of the Russian space system, or they've retired too?
Misha is. Gennady and Sergei are not. Yeah,
yeah.
They left pretty soon after they got back.
And do you know what they're doing? Are they just regular day jobs?
Gennady says he's retired. I don't know what, you know, that's what he told me. Misha has a job in some kind of business,
mm-hmm,
which I don't, you know, in Russia that can mean a million things.
You probably don't want to know.
Working in some kind of business. Sure you are.
Well, you are retired. Is there more you wish you could have done up there? Would you go back? Is there anything you feel like you left undone for yourself?
You know, I had a really fortunate career. I mean, being able to fly on the space shuttle twice, once as the pilot, once as a commander, flew a long duration flight on the space station, and then spent more than twice the amount of time on another flight, did three spacewalks. I mean, there's very few things I haven't done in this space program. And, you know, I have absolutely no regrets. But if they asked me, do you want to fly again? I would say in a second. And I'd be there, you know, even if it meant going to Mars. Although I would need the return ticket.
Yes.
There's a lot of people that, there's this Mars One and they want to do the one-way trip. I wouldn't recommend that.
Yeah.
Having spent a year in space, you'd want to come home after a while.
Well, and one of the things that Gene Creighton, who introduced us, and I have talked about on Lake Effect during our astronomy segments, is the feasibility of going to Mars. And you talk about that quite a bit. That kind of runs through the book as well, that at some point we're going to get there. We're going to figure out how to do this. We're going to solve the challenges. So you would go if we figured it out in our lifetime.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, you get a lot of radiation on the way there. And the way radiation limits work is that the older you are, the more radiation you can get because you have less time to develop a fatal cancer from that radiation. So, you know, maybe a...
Age advantage.
Yeah,
that's so... an age advantage.
Maybe in 20 years I'll be the right age.
One of the other things that you have to do, you're doing it for the book, and you had to do it while you were an astronaut, is the whole PR part of it. And did that ever wear thin for you? Or is that something you just loved being able to say, this is a really cool program and you all should know about it?
You know, I recognize it as part of the job, and I think I got better at it over time. You know, my third flight, which I was in space for 6 months, I wasn't... You know, my absolute priority was doing my job and mission objectives and safety of flight and how's my crew, and that kind of took a back burner. But on this flight, I recognize, you know, the public interest of having an American astronaut in space for that long, you know, kind of elevated my game there a little bit, I think. So I did try to, you know, engage the public. I think NASA's... you know, our customer is the taxpayer, and I think it's a you know, important for us to engage and let you know what we're doing. I think, you know, having a interactive, you know, being an interactive is important too. So we're not just preaching at you or tweeting at you. We are actually having a conversation. And before I flew, the President Obama invited me to the State of the Union address, and while I was there, he challenged me to Instagram the experience. So I did, and I think I did. Miko helped me, and we did a pretty good job. And I also did some discussions, and I'm doing this chat one day on Twitter, and I get a question from the president. And he says, Scott, did you ever look out the window and just freak out? And I said, no, Mr. President, I don't really freak out about anything except getting a question from you. But within like a few seconds, Buzz Aldrin jumps into the conversation and he goes, Mr. President, he's only in low Earth orbit. I went all the way to the moon. So I got trolled while I was in space by the second man on the moon. It's like the greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my entire life.
Scott Kelly speaking on stage at the UWM Union with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. We'll have the rest of their conversation after one more break. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich. Let's get back to Bonnie North's onstage interview with former astronaut Scott Kelly. His recent book is called Endurance. At the end of his event, Kelly took questions from the audience at UWM, including one about what he thought was the most important scientific experiment while he was on the International Space Station.
I'm not a scientist, for one. I do a lot of science. I've made scientific observations. I've operated people's experiments, but I'm not, you know, my profession is not as a scientist. I personally felt like I think the space station as a whole, as a scientific experiment on how to keep people living and working in space for long periods of time, is one of the greatest scientific successes of the space station. Now, if we're talking specific experiments, I think the stuff that was conducted between my brother and I, even though it doesn't have, you know, we only had a sample group of one, so you scientists out there or students, recognize that that's really not an experiment when you only have one sample. It's anecdotal information, basically. But it is interesting information. And for NASA, we had never done any experiments in genetics before. It wasn't really allowed. Actually, the U.S. government is not allowed to ask their employees to participate in genetic-based research. So me asking a question about it after I had been assigned to this flight kind of opened up that as a new area of study, and it allowed NASA to develop procedures and, you know, the just kind of how we would conduct this going forward. So I think that has opened up a new world of research for the for space-based research. Yes, ma'am. Right there.
So kind of a three-part question on the aging piece when you're up in space. What are the systems or the organs that age faster? Does it just, I think you said things age faster?
Yeah. I said it appeared to age faster, I think.
Oh, okay. So when you do come back, how honest and open are you getting your health information from NASA? I mean, are they giving you the information back from the data they're getting?
So, you know, in the book I talk about like the fruits and vegetables seem to like rot at a quicker rate, maybe due to microgravity, and I hope that wasn't happening to me. Now, we did have an experiment on our telomeres between my brother and I, and the telomeres are the things on your chromosomes that are an indication of your physical age, not your age based on when you were born. And the hypothesis would be, because I was in zero gravity and the stress and radiation, my telomeres would be worse than my brother's on Earth. Turned out it was the opposite. Mine got better in space. You know, that's an interesting result about aging. There's also, you know, Einstein's general relativity that says the faster we go for longer periods of time, time slows down due to a person on in a different reference frame, in this case, my brother. And they call that, Einstein, I think, referred to it as the twin paradox. And, you know, some smart guy on the internet did the math and found out I was now 13 milliseconds younger than my brother. I was already 6 minutes younger than him. Now he thinks he's got an extra 13 milliseconds on me. You know, but the suspicion was like me being in space for in this environment, radiation, you know, stress, whatever, that over time I would age more. Like when we get to be 60, I'd look like I was 70 maybe, and my brother would look younger. I think if that happens, what really happened was my brother got Botox. But do they share that information with us? Yeah, they share the stuff that is health related, the science data. Not, you know, it's interesting. The results are not really owned by me. I mean, eventually scientists will publish the information, but until then, unless it's something that would be a health issue, I would probably hear about it, you know, right before the general public would. Yes, sir, in the back.
I wondered if you could speculate, if the species were to move into space, say over several generations, have to live in microgravity, how would we evolve? How would our bodies perhaps change if that happened?
Well, if you didn't do any exercise, like if you never intended to return to Earth, we lose a lot of bone mass, and we do a lot of exercise to prevent that. If you do no exercise, you lose 1% of your bone every month that you're in space. So after 100 months, we would be invertebrates, you know, big sacks of tissue and organs and flesh, but with no skeleton. So we'd be like Gumby. But we'd have to have really strong big toes, because that's how you move yourself around in space. And it's interesting, you get this...
Callus?
You know, yeah, like a callus on the top of your big toe. It's pretty horrible looking. But the good part is your feet are like baby feet. You know, it takes a couple of months to get there of like taking off your socks and getting big, like skin cloud in your face. It's kind of gross. You wouldn't want to do it near one of your crew members.
Right.
Take your socks off. But, you know, when you get back, your feet are really, really soft. When I came back from my previous long flight, no one knew who I was, and I was up there in space, after a couple of days, I went and got a massage at one of these massage places, and the lady's like, you have the softest feet I've ever felt in my entire life. All I said to her was, thank you. I'm very proud of them.
Yes.
And then I left. So I think what we would evolve to is Gumby with a big giant big toe, with a callus on top, but baby feet.
There's a woman right here. Who's,
yeah. Yes, ma'am.
My question is, what advice do you have for our middle school students? You know, we're teaching the Mars generation right now. So what advice in terms of Mars exploration, space exploration do you have for them, or even just becoming an astronaut?
So, first of all, there's a lot of great jobs at NASA and in their, you know, in their space industry for people. And I encourage them to be interested and you know, in those technical fields, because they are so important to our country and our economy. You know, invention and building things is what makes our society continue to grow and expand, so it's critically important. But for the people that want to be, specifically be astronauts, and even more specifically with NASA, there's certain minimum requirements, and it's a bachelor's degree in STEM education, doctor, medical doctor, biologist, chemist, or in some cases, you know, a guy like me that has an engineering degree, but I was, you know, I was chosen really because I was a pilot and a test pilot. And if you want to work for NASA, you know, having experience in those fields is important, because otherwise you wouldn't even be, you know, you wouldn't meet the minimum requirements. But then what I tell people is do something they like. Like, don't become a pilot because you saw me sitting up here and I was a pilot. If you're more interested in chemistry or physics, become a physicist. Be the best physicist you possibly can be. But then do something else, you know, something else that shows that you can work with your hands, you can be part of a team, you can do stuff that's really, really challenging. And, you know, having been on the selection board myself and, you know, part of picking astronauts, you know, we like people that have excelled in their field, but then do other things. The best people I would like seeing is, you know, you get someone that rolls in there that has like a, you know, a PhD from Harvard or Caltech or something, but then they went to like community college and took, you know, auto repair 101 and build their own cars. I mean, those are the type of people that really stand out. How about in the back somewhere?
I can obviously see that you've manned space flight and all that that does, including the risks. But I'm wondering, given the cost and the potential of all the unmanned space exploration being done, how do you bridge that?
Yeah. Yeah, human space flight is expensive. There's no question. We spend a lot of money. I mean, I think it's probably $5 to $7 billion a year on our human spaceflight program. And it's a lot of money. Compared to other things our country spends money on, it's maybe not so much. I think we spend $30 billion a year on Halloween. But still, it's a lot of money. And what I tell people is that, you know, that $5-7 billion, whatever it is, you know, when I was on the space station for a year, I didn't see any money up there. All that money was spent on the ground, you know, with people's jobs, building stuff on the ground, high-tech jobs that have other, you know, advantages to our society. But there is also a place for robotic exploration. I think it's a great balance. You know, I think spaceflight is expensive. We have a lot of priorities in this country. I think it needs to be debated. I think we need to talk about it. But me personally, I think the investment in human spaceflight is worth it. I think we get, you know, improvements to our, you know, our way of life as a result of the space program. I think telecommunications technology, computing power would not be where it is today if we didn't need it for the space program. I think it's important that humans continue to explore. Historically, civilizations that have stopped growing and stopped expanding have ceased to exist, have not thrived. So eventually, I mean, maybe not today, but eventually, you know, we're going to have to expand off of this planet. You know, there's always a place for this planet, and, you know, we are never going to have a better planet than this one. I don't think. We're not going to make Mars like Earth. But if we want to keep growing our economy and our civilization, eventually there's going to be more people living and working in you know, in outer space. So, you know, I think it's important. And if everything I said was absolutely wrong just now, if the only thing we got out of that investment was that kids growing up could say, I have to do my math homework and my physics homework because I want to work at NASA someday and I want to be an astronaut someday, that's worth it, because not all those kids are going to be astronauts, but all those kids that learn math and science are going to contribute something very, very important to our society. And I think the motivation value of that money is worth every penny. How about right here? Yeah.
We have time for probably one more, because I know you wanted to wrap
up. So any kids? Any other kids? All right, kid over there. Someone's pointing at a kid over there. Oh, there she is. I see her.
Yep.
She's the short one right there.
What was the coolest thing you saw in space?
The coolest thing I saw in space? Earth. So beautiful. Yeah, having the privilege of seeing Earth from space really changes you. Makes you, when you see the environment and how thin our atmosphere looks, like a contact lens over our eye, very fragile. Pollution you see in certain places, even though the planet's beautiful, certain places have a lot of pollution. We need to take better care of this planet. We're not making Mars like Earth. There's a place for Mars, but it is not for all of us to move to. We need to take care of planet Earth. We can't go to one of these Kepler planet finder planets anytime soon. If we go there as fast as we can get there, take us 80,000 years. So the people that go will get off that spacecraft as a different species. So we need to better take care of our planet. But unfortunately, thank you. So we don't have much time left. I want you guys to get out of here at a decent hour. And I just wanted to leave you with one final thought as we head out here tonight. And that is, I spent 500 days of my life on the space station. And when I was leaving for the last time in the Russian Soyuz, and I'm backing away, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, you know, how we built this thing that weighs 1,000,000 pounds, size of a football field, in space, in this zero-G environment that makes just about everything harder to do, in extremes of temperatures of plus or minus 270 degrees, we put these modules together, some of which had never touched each other before on Earth. They had never met. First time they're meeting is in space, while traveling around the Earth at impossible speeds, and put together by this international partnership of 15 different countries, different languages, different engineering standards, that this space station is the hardest thing we have ever done. And we can do this, we can do anything. If we want to go to Mars, we can go to Mars. Want to cure cancer, put the money behind it, we can do that. If we want to fix the problems with our environment, challenges in your lives or where you work, I was absolutely inspired after spending a year in space that if we can dream it, we can do it. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Astronaut Scott Kelly speaking on stage at the UWM Union with Lake Effect's Bonnie North in October. Kelly's book is called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. You can find pictures from the event and find more information about Scott Kelly at WUWM.com. We had field engineering support from Jason Reavy and additional production support from Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.